Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we travel back in time to 1987.
When Prince, R.E.M., and The Replacements released classic albums.
And when I had a lot more hair.
Okay, Patrick, another patron episode today.
Yeah.
Some
of my favorites.
We have many to get to, and so let's get to more of them, right? So
yeah.
The way this works on Rockin' the Suburbs, I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
The way this works is that we have patrons of the show. They go to patreon.com/suburbspod, and they help support the show, and there's some various perks. And one of those perks is that every 3 months, patrons at a certain level get to come on the show, be a guest, and pick the topic. That's what's really great about it. Pick the topic. A lot of people enjoy that part of the whole thing. So,
yeah,
today's patron guest is Mike Wagner. Hello, Mike.
Hello, gents.
Hey, always Mike.
Good to talk to you.
You too.
Mike is out in Houston.
That's right.
And how are things in Houston these days?
We had one of the nicest springs ever, but somebody turned the oven on like this week and it's hot again.
Yeah.
It's bound to happen, right?
Yep, yep. But overall, good.
Yeah, all right. All right, and you and the family holding up okay with the pandemic and everything else going on?
Yep, we have been pretty isolated. And doing good. So far, so good.
All right. Very good.
Knock wood.
Okay. So
yeah,
Mike brought to us a pretty interesting topic here, I think. We had another patron not too long ago who wanted to talk about music of a specific year, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was Noah Crane, right? And
yep.
He talked about 1991, which a lot of people, you know, sort of consider one of those great years in rock and roll.
Yeah.
But Mike said, let's talk about a different year, maybe one that isn't recognized in the same way, but had a lot of great music. And what year is that, Mike?
1987.
Yes, I find this very intriguing. This is, this is great for me because I would have been 20 years old that year. And so it's like, this to me is like right at that time when music would just like meant everything.
Same here.
To me. So this there's a lot of cool stuff that came out that year. So tell us why you think 1987 is so great.
Well, one of the things that made it great was that there was a lot of albums that became influential over time, I think. And but at the time, although they were known, they weren't huge. So when you guys were talking about 1991, obviously Nirvana, massive. Everybody knew about it at the time.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Octoon Baby. Everybody knew of it about the time because U2 was all over the place. The other one you did was R.E.M. at a time.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Massive album because they finally had a massive, massive hit with Losing My Religion.
Yes.
Oddly, some of the same artists released albums in 1987, except for U2, they weren't as massive of albums, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sort of like looking, you know, every once in a while you're like, oh, what were the best albums in a certain year? Because you'll be thinking about a certain year. And I pulled it up after that episode. I was looking at different years. And I looked at 1987 and I thought, my gosh, there were some really, really great albums that year. And one that, in particular, a lot of the listeners of this podcast still, I think, listen to quite a lot, right? So I thought it'd be interesting to talk about. And the other thing I find interesting is why was 1991 regarded as such a great year, but 1987 is kind of forgotten?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not sort of recognized. But I think when you look at the quality of the albums at the time, it's on the same level of quality, right? I mean, that being said, I mean, we just said, like, well, we were all in our, you know, early 20s or so around this time. And then, and to be fair, 4 years is a long time, right? And there's a whole new group of people coming in, and it's like they have their thing from that time. But anyway, so I thought it would be interesting to talk about what came out in those years and why didn't they all sort of take off the way things did in sort of 91? Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That's great. So where would you like to start?
Obviously, the big, big album of that year was The Joshua Tree. That album was just huge, and I went back and I looked, and like it was number one for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. Mm. It wasn't like 1 week and off the charts. It was like there for a long, long time. Right. In preparation for this episode, I went back and listened to it, and like it's really good. I understand there's like this whole thing with U2 and Bono, and even back then, right? I mean, there was, you know, I loved them back then, and I still love them now. But obviously there is that U2 thing. But like when you listen to With or Without You, that is, if you just listen to it and just like, it's so well put together. It's so well done. Edge's guitars are just like, when I listen to it, I'm like, my gosh, he works really, if you ever watch him talk about how he does stuff, he really, really works hard at it, right? I mean, it to this day, it just sounds incredible.
Speaking of the sound, a couple things I want to say about this album. I do remember it just being massive at mm-hmm. the time, right? Mm-hmm. But I'll get back to that in a second. Since you're speaking about the sound, I remember this is 87, and I remember being in like an electronics store, like a Best Buy kind of store, something like that, and looking at like car stereos. Like I think I was thinking about buying a new car stereo. I don't know. But they would have that section that would just be like a wall of all these like car stereos stuck in the wall, and then like speakers, you know, like little car stereo speakers next to them, and you could try different ones and test it and everything. There was some guy testing out like a high-end car stereo, and what he was playing was this album, and it opens with Where the Streets Have No Name. And you know how that song opens with the bass coming in and all that kind of stuff, and it sort of builds up. I still have that memory in my mind because I was just sort of blown away with like, this sounds awesome. Like, what a great beginning just sonically to a song, right? It's so cool.
Well, and I'll say this. I mean, I think when you look at their career, up to this point, I think, I don't know. I mean, personally for me, like, War is my favorite U2 album. Like, if it's my favorite. I like Unforgettable Fire a lot too. Those two right in there together.
Yeah.
But I do think Joshua Tree is when they captured best their sweep, their sort of anthemic ability, their ability to hold you know, like Mike said, I saw him play in an arena several times, and they were able to hold that arena spellbound, you know, 20,000 plus people. And of course, they would go on to play to many, many more. But I think it's when they best captured that sweep and sort of the early power, you know, the power of their earlier music right there was that moment. And I personally don't think they ever recaptured any of that early power again. You know, they became something different at that point after Joshua Tree, but they still had enough, like you're talking about with the Streets of No Name, they still had enough of that early, you know, influence, that Sunday Bloody Sunday, I Will Follow kind of drive in that album to really make it deservedly a very popular, high-selling album.
Oh, completely. I mean, they were big already, but this made them, like, really big. This was, like, you know, launched them into the stratosphere. And I remember also distinctly, it's just funny, like, the little things that you that stick with you over all these years. I remember I was in a psychology class at Indiana, and this album came out in what month? This came out in
March. It came out in March.
Yeah, okay.
March of 87.
So this lines up with my memory. I was in psychology class, and a classmate of mine came in, and he had his, you know, Walkman going, and he said, I just, on the way to class, picked up this, the Joshua Tree, the new U2 album. It just, you know, went on sale today. And he was listening, and I was like, well, so how is it? He's like, oh, it's great. And I remember leaving, as soon as the class was over, leaving and going straight to the record store.
Nice.
and getting my own cassette that I could have in a Walkman, you know, that's, and then, but then I also think, you know, being in college in the 80s, and you had that sort of college alternative thing going on.
Yep.
And they fit into that for, you know, especially early in their career, you know, those albums that you're talking about, Patrick, for sure. But then with this album, I remember, you know, it being huge with like sort of all my college alternative friends. But then I would go home in the summer back to Toledo, which was, you know, hanging with like my high school friends and stuff like that, who were maybe a little more mainstream taste. And they loved it, too. You know, so that was kind of like, I knew, like, this album really is something. And then, but the one last thing I want to say, I'm sorry, I'm taking over all your time. You know, I know there's like it's, I feel like it's one of those congressional hearings. There's like a limit. You're over your time. But anyway, Senator,
Mr.
Linehan. But what I want to say,
we're going to Nick Scalera this episode. It's going to go on forever.
But the last thing I want to say is, this also has some really weird songs on it too, though, for as being as like big of a hit as it was. I mean, like a song like Trip Through Your Wires, you know, is just like a weird song. Right. And you know, Bullet the Blue Sky became sort of like a hit song on its own, but it's not like a traditional, like sort of, you know, rock pop song, you know, there's some really cool stuff and some really touching stuff too. Running to Stand Still. I mean, I think
it's really
I think it is. I think it is a really good album. I think, you know, maybe it got sort of oversaturated. And then, you, like you said, later on in their career, there became this kind of YouTube backlash. I don't really subscribe to that. I still like them. I mean, I like everything they do these days, but I still like them as a band. And but anyway, it's a very interesting record. It's a really cool record. So, all right.
But you would agree that it at that time, it was just... It was so massive.
Yeah.
It was so massive. It's like, it was just like in, and it just, it sort of took up, I kind of think it took up some oxygen from some other albums. It was so big.
That could be. Mm-hmm. I mean,
do you think that?
I think they also, they hit at a time, this was a time probably when we needed a new rock band. You know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of the big, you know, sort of classic rock bands were on the descent or had broken up at this time, and it, I think the timing for U2 was just perfect, right? Like, we need a new biggest band in the world. Well, here you go.
Right,
you
know? Right.
So anyway,
Well, there was that moment where they played the Conspiracy of Hope tour in 86, and the Police reunited for that tour. And Sting said he remembered, like, U2 played the last song. And he said they remember giving their instruments over to U2 so they could play the last song. And they were like, yeah, that's kind of, that was kind of, because the Police before them were probably the biggest band.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And they sort of handed it over, and it was like, yeah, this is kind of like, it was the end of the road for the Police and the U2.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So let's, we could probably spend a whole episode on this one album, but let's, a couple other ones that I was thinking about. And the band that was kind of always mentioned with U2 back in the day was REM.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And they released Document that year.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is just like a great album. It may be my favorite REM album. I know it's of any band that's hard to pick your favorite album. REM is probably the hardest one because there's so many great albums. But that album to me, I find myself going back to it quite a lot, especially now. If you listen to the lyrics, they actually speak quite well now. Somehow, I don't know how. It's like, and I know that one. I know they had their first hit with, quote unquote, hit with the one I love.
Right.
And then obviously it's the End of the World as We Know It is on there, but it starts off with such urgency with Finest Work Song.
The time to rise has been.
This one was also huge with me. I remember, for whatever reason, playing this one a lot in the car. Like, I just had, like, a cassette of this that I just played a lot in the car. It sounded really great. It was the last of their IRS albums.
Yes, it was.
And it feels different than the others, than the previous four. It feels like they're making that transition already a little bit. But, Scott Litt produced this.
Scott
okay.
Litt.
Yeah.
Yep.
It had kind of a bigger sound and a cleaner sound than their other stuff. But you're right. Again, I kind of, sort of like with you too, I kind of point to the weirdness of this record. The songs, it's even more so in REM's case. I mean, yes, they had a hit single that sounds like a pop song. And then they also had, it also has It's the End of the World as We Know It, which is probably one of their best known songs over time for sure. But there's so many weird things on this record, like Lightning Hopkins, like that,
song, that song,
and King of Birds. I do too. Disturbing at the Heron House. There's like, it's a weird and wonderful sort of record, I think, you know. I wish all bands would, you know, if all bands would sort of mature that way, if, you know, if they're looking at becoming, reaching out to a bigger audience, most of them do the quote, you know, many of them, I guess, would do the quote unquote, like, sort of sellout record. Right. But this doesn't feel like that at all. It feels like they're sort of growing on their own terms and reaching people without, you know, without ceasing to be REM.
Yeah, that's well said.
When I was reading up about it, on all the REM albums, they have different. It had File Under Fire.
Yeah,
right. Because he had File Under Water for one of them. I can't remember which one it was, and File Under something, whatever. They would have that little note on the albums, and this one was File Under Fire, because it was like there's an intensity to this record that still resonates with me, and I really really enjoy it. It did have hits, but again, it wasn't part of this overall. I mean, it was in the stew of 1987, and going back to the premise of the episode, it's like it didn't. So there wasn't the cohesiveness of 87 like there was in 91. Is it? You know what I'm saying? But again, I think that's a fantastic album, and I can't recommend the version of King of Birds that's on tour film enough. That is so good.
Yeah.
That's so good.
I love that song.
So a couple more albums.
Uh-huh.
The next one is Prince's Sign of the Times.
Fancy skinny man died of a big disease with a little name.
by chance, his girlfriend came across a needle, and soon she did the same. At home, there are 17-year-old boys, and their idea of fun is being in a gang called the Disciples, high on crack, toting a machine gun.
I know some people are like, too much 80s production on that one, but still, there's some, and I love a good sprawling double album that kind of goes all over the place. And this is Prince's, you know, many people regard it as his best album, and I love it. I mean, I think it's fantastic. Thoughts on that, guys?
Well, I think it's a really interesting Prince record in the sense that, you know, kind of how at one point Springsteen was no longer recording with the E Street Band. This is the first one, I think I'm correct on this, where he wasn't using the Revolution. And
that's correct.
You know, I think that led to it being a little more sprawling. He took some more chances. You know, there were some co-writers on this record that it's something he hadn't done a whole lot of. And him just kind of, you know, seeing what else he could do. Like, how far could his tendrils go from where they already were? And I think he was at a place in his career where he was successful enough to be able to kind of do whatever he wanted at this point. This record to me kind of feels like that. I was listening to a little bit of it this morning. I haven't listened to it in a long time. It's great. It's deep. It's not as on the surface, doesn't grab you. There wasn't any, you know, like giant hit singles on this, you know, like there were on previous albums. It's different in a lot of ways. It really is. And it's cool. It's one of those, to me, real gems in the Prince catalog.
One of my favorite Prince albums, if not my favorite. I mean, it's so great. And
yeah.
I remember this because, so this came out in March of 87, and I got it on cassette because this was when I was still in college and my Walkman was sort of more important than anything else.
Yeah.
So I would buy a lot of, you know, stuff on cassette. And I did a study abroad thing in the summer that year in Italy, and I wanted to, you know, of course, to take my Walkman, and I could only, you know, pack so many cassette tapes to bring on
right.
the trip. So I had to choose wisely. What am I going to listen to this summer?
Yeah.
And I took this record, this cassette. I think part of it probably was because it was a double album on one cassette, so I'm getting more songs.
Yeah.
Then other things.
You were going to say that. That's interesting. Yeah.
Other things I would pick, right? But I played this tons that summer, and just loved it. And you know, this won't come as a surprise to anyone, you know, with Prince, but it's so varied. Like, there's stuff that's just all over the place on this record. It's so cool. I mean, I think You Got the Look was probably a pretty big hit. I don't know, but but you're right. But like Sign of the Times, the song, the way it opens, just felt like you hadn't heard something like that from Prince before.
That's
like,
great.
Like, just like musically, maybe he kind of done some things like that, but it was so like well done. And then the like social commentary and the lyrics just felt like it was, you know, something new and different coming from Prince. Mm-hmm. And yet it seemed so like honest and true, you know. That's a tremendous song. And then the album also has what maybe my favorite, probably my second. Let's say my second favorite Prince song. I think my favorite Prince song is Kiss, but the next one would be I Could Never Take the Place of Your Man.
Yeah.
I was surprised that wasn't a massive hit.
Yeah.
It's a jam. I kind of was like, it is like, I mean, I know the version on the album is you know, it has that long drawn out jam at the end, but they could have edited it for a single.
Yeah. Because it is, it's like a rock song, you know? And that's,
yeah.
I mean, again, it shouldn't be too surprising. I mean, Prince, you know, coming off of like Purple Rain, three albums earlier, I mean, he can obviously do rock songs, but it's just like so, like, perfectly written, this one, you know? It's just so tight and hooky, yeah.
And his, just going back to the title song, Sign of the Times, his guitar in that song, fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't stand out, but Prince is a guitar player. He was like, I mean, obviously when he wanted to like blow everybody away, it's like, okay, everybody just move out of the way. I'm going to play now. But he also was very, very subtle in a lot of his guitar playing. And man, that his guitar playing in that song is outstanding.
I think I'm going to be listening to it here for the next couple of weeks because I haven't pulled it out in a long, long time and I forgot how great it was.
The last one of my big ones from that era was obviously because every episode I'm on, I talk about the Replacements and everybody loves the Replacements, or they should. Pleased to Meet Me. This day, I don't see how that album was not just a huge, massive album, because it seems pretty clear to me that a lot of the people, speaking of 19, and this is kind of what made me think of that, of 1987 somewhat when we were talking about the 91 episode, is when I hear Pleased to Meet Me, I hear a lot of that sound in the 1991 songs, especially like if you take the bit In the song Nevermind, which, by the way, that was the name of the Nirvana album. That bit when he comes out and there's those churning guitars and they're like laid over and it just sounds great. And Paul does that thing. It's just like that to me is like that essence of 91.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, us as a podcast, Rocking the Suburbs, have ever done anything related to this album cover or anything like that. Didn't make a sticker with a similar picture.
who would do such a thing?
Pretty arrogant. I'll tell you guys this, though. I remember this one very clearly. Jim told a really cool story about leaving class and going to buy a brand new album. But I'll tell you, I remember very, very clearly this day. It was June. Looking it up, I knew it was summertime. I was fully a dropout at this point, so I was well on my way to my career. And I went into this Plan 9 Records in Charlottesville, where I was hanging out with some friends who lived down there and was staying down there during the summer. And Andy and I used to drive down from here. You know, it's about, I don't know, an hour and a half, something like that, down to Charlottesville, and we would spend a lot of time hanging out. But I went into Plan 9 Records on that day, and I bought two albums. One was Pleased to Meet Me by the Replacements, and the other was Sister by Sonic Youth. And they came out on the same day, and those two albums are like, became sort of a cornerstone. I would say to this day, they're like pillars in my vinyl collection, you know, the tent poles that kind of hold other stuff up. Amazing to think that they came out on the same day, and bands that were going in two different directions. I mean, Jim and I were lucky enough on the other podcast to actually go to the studio, Arden Studios in Memphis, and sit there and do an interview with Bob Mayer, who wrote fantastic book Trouble Boys, and he was talking about the recording of this album, the only one they recorded as a trio. But, you know, the Replacements went in a different direction. They tried to become You know, more popular. They sort of elusively, you know, chased and never quite got, you know, a hit single or more widestream success at in their original incarnation. And Sonic Youth just kind of continued to go on their pattern. But Sister was maybe their very best album, at least in my opinion, one where they really took that noisy early part of Sonic Youth and blended it with more songwriting stuff that they would do later on, Daydream Nation and Washing Machine and some of those albums that they put out on Geffen Records, Goo, stuff like that. So, I don't know, it's kind of amazing to think 87, there's so many seeds planted in this year if you go back and look at some of the other records that came out. And the other one I wrote down was Dinosaur Jr., You're Living All Over Me, came out in 87 too. So, another hugely influential indie sort of, you know, rock album that came out in that year. There's so many interesting seeds that were planted.
Oh,
in this
totally.
Year.
So
yeah,
the Pleased to Meet Me thing. I know there's a lot of Replacements fans who don't want to, who don't like this necessarily, but I think it probably is my favorite Replacements album. But but you know, it's the first one without Bob, and so I think to a lot of people that. A lot of the true fans, maybe that puts it down below, you know, Let It Be and Tim. But the thing I find so appealing, just because I love Paul Westerberg as a songwriter so much, and so I really love this album because it was the first album where he had essentially complete control.
Yeah, and, that's right, Jim. Yeah,
and he just, you know, to use a cliche, he just knocked it out of the park. I mean, I think there's just so many great songs here. And I think, you know, it's Paul Unleashed. It's like him doing some of the stuff that maybe, you know, Bob would have laughed at or whatever and, you know, would have got the rest of the band on his side and said, no, we're not going to record that, you know. And, he, you know, here he gets to do those things like, you know, a song like Skyway, for example, or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, you know, it opens just tremendously with IOU, which might be a, I think some people, you know, that guitar on that is insane, right, Mike? You're a guitarist. I mean, it's, it's crazy. You know, and that's Paul playing that, not Bob. And, you know, they didn't have Slim yet. So that's Paul doing
right.
that stuff.
Right.
You know, the, oh God, I'm just looking at this listing. It goes IOU and then it goes into Alex Chilton, right?
Yeah, that's
right. It's another just great guitar and just a great pop song. And, you know, got so many, you know, kids like me to discover Big Star and all that stuff. And
that's, you know, another great point. Yep. Then that's when about when I started getting into them as well.
Yeah, then there's some, you know, kind of weird songs. And then that I mean, I think Side Two is just killer. It's like one rock song after another, you know. It's it's really just amazing. And then the ending, you know, you go Skyway and then perfectly segues into Can't Hardly Wait, which I think might be their best song that they've ever done. You know, it's just, you know, it's hooky and it's just like touching and beautiful and so well produced. And the drums on it are really great. And we heard a story on, you know, sort of how they got that drum sound from Bob Mayer.
Yeah,
you know, some of the techniques they had to use to get... to get Chris to loosen up because he just wasn't that kind of a drummer. He didn't have that kind of swing, but they've, you know, Jim Dickinson, you know, figured out how to make it work. And I think it's just, it's a great combination of like songwriting, creativity, and, you know, like production, you know, just like sound, you know, all the pieces really came together on this. And they, and that wasn't always the case with the Replacements stuff.
No.
You know, an album like Tim, which was their first major label album, great songs on it and some great playing, but a lot of, you know, but the production not nearly as good as this, you know.
It sounds
totally
terrible.
Yes.
It does not sound good. It's real. Yeah. That is a tragedy. That album should have been, they're both great albums, but it's a tragedy that album.
Yeah. Well, to me, this just felt like the band was, you know, coalescing around Paul, and he was like, "I am your leader now, and follow me." And they were, and they followed, you know, and they did it, and it just and it really, really worked. So,
and I'll tell you, I was just doing a little research here, and I pulled up the Village Voice 1987 critics poll. And of the top four records, three of them we've discussed in this poll. So Prince, Sign of the Times is number one. Replacements, Replacements, Pleased to Meet Me, number 3. Joshua Tree, number 4. What do you think came in second, guys? So you got Prince at number 1, Replacements 3, U2 at number 4. What do you think was second? 1987.
This is Village Voice?
Sonic Village Youth. Voice Critics Poll.
Sonic Youth.
Was it is not document.
Was it? It wasn't Guns N' Roses, was it?
No. But that's a great shout because that album came out this year, too. Two incredible debut albums in this year. Yeah. Number 1, Guns N' Roses. Actually, 3, if you count an EP called Come On Pilgrim. Also, Public Enemy put out their first album in 87. Yeah. No, it is Bruce Springsteen's Tunnel of Love.
Yeah.
Surprising that it got that high. So, R.E.M. came in number 8. And also, Warren Zevon, Sentimental Hygiene, came out this year, which is a great album. I think has grown in stature. I don't think it was necessarily, when it came out, people weren't that, you know, super crazy about it. But, man, it's really held up.
I love that record.
Yeah, it's a great record. It really is. And the Smiths had Louder Than Bombs in Strange Ways in 87. There was a lot going on in many different. And, of course, Warehouse, Songs and Stories was a major label album from Husker Du.
And then also, you had in 87, The Cure had Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me, which took them to a new level. That was their first time they had real hits, right?
That's right, yeah.
And then, what else?
That is one of the most brilliant pop songs ever, is Just Like Heaven. It's just like, I mean, does anybody not like that song? I mean, I'm sure somebody does it. Yeah. Somebody be like writing in, like, oh, I hate that song.
Which song?
I think it's
Just Like Heaven. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. But didn't that album also have Why Can't I Be You? I really like that one a lot.
Yeah.
Also, that came out that year, and here's a band I think just had a ton of hit songs, but I don't know. It doesn't resonate so much anymore. I don't know, but INXS.
Had that album. They were enormously popular.
Yeah, they had that album Kick, came out in 1987.
Yep, that's right.
I had that album on my list. That is a fantastic pop album.
Yeah.
The non-hits on there are really good. I remember listening to that album a lot back in the day. Devil Inside was like, it hasn't sort of carried forward, but if you go up, it does sound very 80-ish when you kind of listen to it, but but it's still, the songs are really good. So
it does, but I would say in their case, it's like in a good way. Like I kind of like, that I think we all like, you know, sort of gravitate toward the idea of like, oh, certain songs or records are kind of like timeless or whatever, but there's also something to be said for an album that puts you in a time too. You know, think of like the Yardbirds, for example. Like the Yardbirds sound so 60s when you listen to their stuff, right? But it's cool music, and it's sort of like, you know, I don't know, puts you in a certain time and place. And I kind of, you know,
true.
Why
Good
can't
point.
There be something like that for the 80s too, if it's done well, you know.
Yeah,
it's like, you know, take like Cyndi Lauper, for example, same kind of thing. Like you hear a Cyndi Lauper record and it's like immediately transforms you back into like the colorful 80s, right? But that's not necessarily a bad thing, you know. So I think INXS, I don't know, I think my appreciation of them has grown over the years. I think back in the day I kind of, aside from a couple of songs, I kind of like, well, you know, they're pop stars. I don't have, you know, much time for that. But I have come to really appreciate their music a lot more since I've, you know, become less jaded, right?
Yeah. And I'll tell you, too, looking through some of this other stuff here, an album, a band I didn't know about in 1987, Spaceman 3, I've talked a little bit about them. They put out The Perfect Prescription, which is now my favorite Spaceman 3 album, so also very interesting. And also right on that same day came out The House Martins, The People Who Grinned Themselves to Death, which is a great record that took me a while to get into, but it's a fantastic, you know, sort of UK pop record. And we don't even have time to get into Kiss's Crazy Nights, which came out.
Oh, wow. That year. No, we don't.
I'm just going to, for a lot of reasons.
I'm going to mention two more records real quickly here. One was Jesus and Mary Chain Darklands came out year.
Right.
And then also, this one was really, really big for me. I listened to this one a lot. Midnight Oil's Diesel and Dust.
Yeah. Wow. I saw that. That's a great one.
I loved that record. And I think part of it, you know, talk about a record that's not timeless, like this would be one of those. But I think part of it, too, was my age at the time. It's like my you know, young adulthood and being in college and all of that kind of stuff. It's like, this record is about something, you know, it has something to say, right? and that really appealed to me. But that aside, I loved just the intensity, like Peter Garrett's intensity.
Yes.
I just thought was just awesome. He was so cool. And I saw them live on that tour. And
I did too.
And
yeah.
It was one of the, I still think it was probably one of the best shows I've ever seen, just because.
Scared the crap out of
me. Yeah.
They were frightening, man. Because he was like 6'5 or 6'6, bald headed, crazy guy.
Right.
Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one thing I'll say too, an album that actually features an appearance by Bono, if I'm not incorrect on this, was Robbie Robertson's debut album, just called Robbie Robertson. That one, you know, I think he was recording with Daniel Lanois and Eno. Was that right?
Yep, he did.
Yep, Lanois, I'm sorry. Lanois. And, that became, you know, he had never put out a solo album before, and that was a big moment for him, the guy who wrote, you know, most of the songs for the band, and, you know, took him down a different road as well. So 87, what a year.
Okay. All right, we got to wrap this up. Thanks very much, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. This very interesting year.
I like I said, when I look back, I was like, man, there's a lot of good stuff there. I mean, they weren't all massive albums, but I hadn't thought of it the way you said it, but again, it planted a lot of seeds and a lot of really good stuff.
All right. Thanks very much. If anyone else would like to be a patron of our show, go to patreon.com/suburbspod. If anybody has comments about the music of 1987, then you should call and leave a message and we'll get your voice on an upcoming episode. The number is 612-440-1984.
Not 87.
Not 87. 80.
We'll talk about 84 another time.
Yeah.
Actually, we may have already. I can't remember. But anyway,
possible.
I think we did.
Have.
That was a big one.
I think we have.
Okay. Also, you can email rock@suburbspod.com, where you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of those @suburbspod. All right. Thanks again, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
Take care. We'll talk with you again soon.
All right, guys. That was great fun. Thanks so much.
Yep, thank you. And it's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
With us has been
Mike Wagner.
And we'll talk to you guys later.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I feel fine.
Offer me solutions, offer me alternatives, and I decline.